Coast to coast, border to border, and around the world. It's time for The Bill Alexander Show. The Bill Alexander Show is a guest-driven program where the topics are diverse and entertaining. Laugh and learn while you listen to one of the best hours of online radio. Now, here's your host, Bill Alexander.
Hey, everybody, yours truly, William Eric Alexander. All my friends call me Bill, and welcome to this edition of the Bill Alexander Show. Today, we have a guest that's returning, had her on the program, hard to believe, May 26th, 2022. It's been a long time, and we have Jocelyn Jones. Jocelyn, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and it's wonderful to be back on your show. We had such a lively conversation the first time,
and
I always enjoy, it's an honor to be here. I always enjoy being here.
And the first time we had you on the program, we were talking about your book.
Yes.
Which is The Artist Awakening the Spirit Within, and I have my copy, as you can see, and how is book sales going? Is it, I've been reading some things about it over the last year or so, and it seems like it's going very well.
It is going very well. It's kind of, you know, people liken it a lot to The Artist Way because it has a lot of exercises in it. And it's doing very well. And I'm very pleased. Sometimes I go, oh my God, I wrote that book. Should I write another? But I've gotten wonderful response and letters, and it's gotten, you know, reviews I couldn't have written for myself, and 18 international book awards. So it's done pretty well. But the thing that pleases me the most is when people say, I read your book and it really changed my life. It really helped me. Because the book, you know, the aim of the book, even though it's a memoir, it also talks about my whole teaching of acting history. And how I found a way to hack those same lessons that I give actors for people to apply them to their life. And my ideal is to help people to treat their life as a personal masterpiece. I believe there's an artist in everyone, and they can take charge of their life and get connected to their inner voice about why they're here and what do you want to do. And it's not too late to dream. And it's not too late to do things about it. It's not too late to create your own life as a canvas.
For those of you that did not listen to the first episode, Jocelyn is an actress. She is a teacher. And her new role is she's a grandmother. So she's playing all these roles, but she was in the Clint Eastwood film, The Enforcer. And if you can see behind me, there she is on my wall, right there. And she was also in one of my favorite films, which I still think is the precursor to Thelma and Louise, The Great Texas Dynamite Chase from 1976, which was a great film. I don't think it would be able to be made today, but back then, it was enjoyable.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun to make. Couple babes out there robbing banks and getting cars until we got to have fun, ended up with a Rolls Royce. And, you know, Thelma and Louise, we even had the guy, you know, we picked up the guy and he became my boyfriend. And, you know, it doesn't get much more fun than that. You know, I think we made it for $100,000, you know. The fun thing about independent filmmakers is that, you know, my daughter and son-in-law are independent filmmakers. They make movies for, you know, $1 million, under $5 million. And right. You have to get inventive. You know, you have to use your imagination. How are we going to get this shot? How are we going to? Mm-hmm. And lots of, you know, even cameramen will tell you, you know, when you don't have money, you have to apply your imagination. And that goes back to the book, is the most powerful thing we have is our imagination. If you can see it, if you can imagine it, you can have it.
So with the actors and writers strike that was going on since May, that's recently came to an end, did people start finding some of your old work? Have you seen any residuals from this, or do you not see those anymore?
No, I still see residuals, and I get strange fan mail. And recently I got somebody from Colombia asked me to do a podcast, and I did that podcast, and they had to have an interpreter, and that was very interesting. And you know, I finally at the he had asked me about every film I've made from the very, very beginning. I had no, I, you know, I haven't acted in quite a few years. So I had to go like, oh yeah, wow, that thing, you know, and try to come up with a story for them. But we had a lot of fun. So he was, I said, can I ask a question? And he said, yeah. I said, how did I get on your radar?
Right.
And I think he saw an independent film I made, I don't even know where he saw it, but he saw a film, independent film where I have one scene in this film. And then he saw me and he thought, is that the same woman that, you know, was in Tourist Trap that I saw when I was a teenager and it scared the hell out of me? And then he looked that up. And that's what he does. You know what they do? He said, you know, we don't have so many film schools and acting schools. So we will, you know, be enamored with an actor or a director or a writer. And then we will go and look at everything they've ever done. And I thought it was fascinating. And I don't know how that goes with the language either, because he didn't speak almost any English. But it was interesting. So yeah, you know, it's always part of the wonder is how people find you and what they see and what's out there on the internet. And, that, you know,
that's interesting. It really is, because I know that a lot of us were looking for things to watch because they shut everything down. And now that everything's back up again, it's really nice. Now, I thought about this before I came into the studio and sat down, is that when actors are out of work, do they go back to school or do
they like to go to class. Did not teach.
Okay.
I did not teach. You know, teaching is a huge responsibility, and you know, I don't do anything a little bit. I'm either all in or not at all. And now that I have a grandbaby, which is my favorite role of my entire life, I'm back to New York quite a bit.
Okay.
You know, I keep a little apartment in New York. So I couldn't, you know, leave class and go to New York for 6 weeks. I like to have my freedom. You know, I might do a seminar at some point. Again, I wouldn't film it because it took 3 years to edit.
Well,
but, you know, I think of doing like limited, you know, things there, but not go back to teaching a class. If I had, it would have been full, I can tell you.
What's interesting is that when we did the last program a year and a half ago, you told me about the masterclass and you were getting ready to do it and everything else. And I've been sitting on my edge of my seat waiting for it to come out. And it finally came out, finally had to watch some of it. And it is amazing how you were able to take a classroom experience and basically make it into something that we could all relate to in some way, shape, or form, which I thought was very good, because a lot of people, when they do a master class, it's just very one-sided. It's not, there's no real interaction to it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, our goal, and we're very proud of it. Our goal was to really put you in the room as if you were a student in that class, and to be able to see it from all sides. You know, we didn't, you know, if I were ever to do it on a big scale and we weren't paying for absolutely everything, I would have, you know, filmed some of their rehearsal processes, because those are fascinating. But, you know, those actors, they've rehearsed 20, 40, 60 hours. They, you know, I tell them, you have to do everything you know how to do as an actor to a scene. And that is a masterclass. So those are the master part of it, is that those actors have been training, some of them for 20 years, and they know what they're doing. And so when they bring the scene, you know, sometimes I was watching the scene, I go, this is so good. What am I going to say? You know?
Yeah.
And but then I always come up with something. So you see the work, you see this very, very completed work with some of the great writers of all time. You know, I know I wanted to go into the classics, into some plays from the 30s. waiting for Lefty, things that were reverberating today, you know, things about strikes and
right.
no money and, you know, everything sort of in history comes back around, unfortunately. But anyway, so they do this fantastic work, and then they talk about the work, which is part of the training. What did you want to accomplish? How did you apply the technique? You know, what did you want to accomplish, and how do you feel you did? So I'm training them to know that they know mm-hmm. how to go about a scene. Because otherwise, we're always inventing the wheel as actors. We do a film and it does well, but then we go to do the next film and we go, I don't know what I'm doing, you know? So my goal in training actors is to have them have certainty about their work, how to approach their work, and their ability to tap into inspiration. This is what spilled over into the book, is that their choices, and they're the choices that, you know, when actors go on auditions, they think many of them can kind of hear, they have a very strong idea of what the director wants. And so having been on the other side of an audition, you will audition 10 people for a part and 9 of them will do exactly the same thing.
Okay.
Because they hear it in their head and they get this idea of what they think is right. We all want to be right. We're terrified of not being right. So my teaching is very strongly about listening to your own inner voice and finding your own inspiration and finding that thing that you have to offer the part that isn't on the page. You know, the writer writes the script and then the actor writes a story underneath that script that's their own. And when an actor like that comes in an audition, they get the part because it's like, oh my God, they show you something you didn't see before. And that's how I want to train actors.
Of the 16 actors that were part of this, did they volunteer to do it? Did you pick them from a list? How did they get involved with the masterclass?
Well, I sent out an email saying I was going to do this and who might be interested. And I got an enormous response back. And so I chose actors who have studied with me for a long time. I always like a lot of variety in my classes. And so even for the seminar with that limited amount of actors, usually I have 50 students in a room, 75 okay. students in a room. This was going to be 16, very small, very intimate class. And I want a variety of color. I want a variety of age. I want as much variety in that company of players. You know, they sort of become a company of players. And I wanted them to be experienced because I wanted it to be a masterclass. So they were all working actors. They're all actors who work in the industry
okay.
at different levels. There was one young girl. She did so well. She's a great example of what happens when you get into a room, you play tennis with better players, your uh-huh. game, you know, comes up. And she was just out of university and she was the youngest one in the room. And I'm not always very pleasant about university training because university training trains you to make the same choices that everybody else does.
Yeah.
You know? So it sort of reinforces that. And it teaches people kind of representational acting. So they show you what it would look like if I felt this way, rather than kind of entering the magic of creating a whole nother reality and really having those feelings because you believe in this alternative reality you've created. So she just made that switch very, very quickly. She's very dedicated. The most important thing about an actor is their dedication.
It's interesting to hear you talk about university. As I mentioned earlier, my son does it, and I have a daughter now who is a junior in high school who loves theater, and she's mm-hmm. performing, and she has a teacher or a director that was a stage performer. Mm-hmm. And one thing I'm noticing is that it's sometimes difficult for someone that was on the stage performing to sit back and direct or teach because they're trying to jump in and know this is what you need to do and correct it and let the student learn through their mistakes. And I'm wondering if you've seen that when you get someone from a university level, in that situation, because like you said, everybody's doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, teaching is a calling, you know, and you know, I don't want to, but I'm going to say it anyway. There are a lot of bad teachers, you know, and as you know from my book, mm-hmm. you know, I just did not do well with teachers. I don't even believe in teachers. I say to my students, I don't, you know, I don't believe in teaching. I don't know how much longer I'm going to do this because, you know, I believe, you know, people have to discover for themselves, and particularly artists, because, you know, I think I told you before, I looked for a definition of art that I could get behind, you know, and okay. I love dictionaries. I looked at all these dictionaries and, you know, they said all kinds of highfalutin things, but it didn't, nothing resonated with me. And so I kind of looked at it and I thought, well, what do I think? You know, what is my definition of art? And it became very, very simple. My definition of art is the expression of that which you have discovered. So if you haven't discovered something, and we all know when we discover something, we're kind of like, oh, you know, wow, the light bulb goes off. We have an aha moment. And then you express that either with a painting or a piece of choreography or in writing or whatever it is. But if you haven't made a discovery, it's going to be derivative. And most, you know, university training, most theater, most musicals, although they're the most fun thing in the world to do, but most of them are derivative, meaning they are learned by what you have seen before. Oh, it looks like this. Let me do it like this. And that's kind of the opposite of what I train people to do, because I want them to, you know, I want them to discover for themselves. I want, that's what, you know, that's the art that we go like, wow, I've never seen that before. And then it becomes universal. It's the oddest thing. If it really comes from you, everybody recognizes it. So
I'll go back. You say that doing a musical and doing it the same way it's done before, but there's sometimes the audience wants it done the same way before because that's what they enjoyed. And they're getting what I call that rocking chair effect, that it makes them feel comfortable if they can recite it, predict it, and feel it the way they did the first time. And how does an artist able to break out of that shell if they take a role like Willie Loman and break out of it and do something totally different that maybe the writer didn't think possible, or we're in 2023 compared to when it was written a half a century ago? Yeah. How do you update it, and how do you make it manifest?
Because, well, you know, Dustin Hoffman did a Willie Loman.
Yes.
Brian Dennehy did a brilliant Willie Loman. They were entirely different. They were not like anything ever seen before. Brando and Streetcar, those things, you've never seen that before. You go, how did they get there? They made it personal. It's their heartbeat, their blood. They loaned all of that to the character and entered that character in a real way. We don't see that very often, but I guarantee you, when that happens, it is always a success. Mm-hmm. I can't think of her name right now, but I'm sorry. Can you just, is my phone dinging away?
No, that's okay.
Okay. There's a brilliant Janet Tierney, I think, did a Doll's House on Broadway that I saw, and I was astounded. I was astounded by what she did with that part. It came from her imagination. It came from her heart. It was so personal. And what happens when an actor works like that and finds that is, more than being entertained, the rocking chair effect of being entertained. Oh, I know this. I love this. You know, Oklahoma, where the wind, you know, oh, it's lovely, wonderful. Rather than that, when somebody is really experiencing that life, we leave our seats. We leave our life. We enter the peace. We release from our own doldrums and our own life. and we enter another reality, an imaginary reality, a parallel reality, where a human being is behaving and experiencing that exactly as they would in life. And then we tend to think, my God, if he can create that life before my very eyes, maybe I can do a little better with my own.
Right.
And that's why I wrote the book. Because you can.
Because recently you posted online about the book, All the Light We Cannot See.
Oh, and
have you seen the Netflix series yet?
Yes, I have. It's spectacular.
And again, Hugh Laurie in that is an amazing actor to me, because he's able to play the father of Stuart Little. He's able to play a doctor that in House that I don't know how to describe him and everything else he's done. And now he's playing a,
he's on the spectrum. Isn't that doctor in House on the spectrum?
Spectrum, yeah. He's playing a French resistance. And it is just, it's just so well done.
He's damaged. And
that's what I was, because that's where you could compare the House character and this character, because he's damaged. And
he's
he just does such a wonderful job with that. And it's interesting that we've never seen him in anything more. And if we have seen him, he doesn't stand out because he is that character.
Yeah, sometimes that happens. You know, they're actors who are overlooked by the public. They're not overlooked by, actors or directors, but they sometimes are overlooked by the public. Bill Nighy is an English actor, and he's in everything, and I just love him. You know, Bill, it comes down to intention. You are either intending to show something, and then there are English actors, that's the way they're trained, and they do it very, 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 very well. The difference is with American actors and the whole, you know, movement, you know, in the 30s, Brando and all of those people from the actor studio, the idea was to really experience the feelings in front of you, which it just is, you know, it's hard to look at that. It's hard to look at, you know, Laurie in that as that damaged man. Sometimes you go, oh, because you're experiencing it. In the first, you know, iteration of English actors showing you every tiny detail, it would look like this. And sometimes they actually trip into the feelings. But when it's shown to you how it would look like if I was having these feelings, you know, it's very impressive. And it's entertaining, and we're taken by it, but we won't remember it. When you see someone actually have the experience in front of your eyes in this imaginary reality, you never forget it. It moves in you. You know, you go, oh my God. So it's really a matter of intention. You know, the university actor is intending one thing.
Right.
A trained actor to this kind of work is intending something else.
Would you say the same thing about your father's work?
Well, you know, my father would be the first one to say that the actors of my generation are so much better. He wished that he was born in a time. He went to an acting school with an acting teacher named Jasper Dieter in Philadelphia, who was absolutely cruel. He was the first of the mean acting teachers. And I'm telling you, there are some mean freaking acting teachers out there who really hurt sensitive actors, and I want to beat them up. But he will tell you, you know, he had experiences, but I don't know what this guy gave him, except, and they do it. They said, we're toughening you up because it's a tough career. And I want to say, I want to curse at them right now. I want to say, anyway, he learned doing it. You know, he just went to New York and did what he could to get on Broadway, and he ended up on Broadway and then, you know, ended up in LA. But he would be the first one to say that the evolution of acting has been quite something, and that it's very, you know, there's a famous quote of I think Olivier said to someone or other, you know, why don't you try acting, my dear? I think he said it to Dustin Hoffman in the thing with the dentist and the teeth and the that Dustin Hoffman movie with Olivier.
Was that
do you remember
Tootsie?
The name of it?
Was that Tootsie?
What? No, not Tootsie. This is a thriller.
A thriller. What was it?
A thriller. And Olivier plays this evil guy who pulls Dustin Hoffman's teeth out of his head. It's a terrible scene. Anyway, you know, Hoffman really went too far with the whole method thing. Because I think his intention was to show people what a deep actor he was and how much he had to do to get what he, I mean, he's a brilliant actor, mind you, Dustin Hoffman. But, you know, he was cruel to people on the set. He was cruel to Meryl Streep on the set. That's not necessary. That's not necessary. I would say to my actors, you know, you enter and you exit freely. You know, you don't have to be in character, you know, 24/7. You're not going to fall out of character if you don't, you know, sort of act the same way the character is to your husband. I will tell you, one time my husband said to me, I was working on a piece and we were in a little bit of a fight, and I said something to him, I don't remember what it was, but I said something to him and he looked up at me frozen and he went, "That is a line from the piece that you are working on. You do not drag that into this house." I was so embarrassed. I had created the whole situation so I could figure out what that line was all about. Anyway.
Because I know that when Hoffman was in Rain Man, he got into the character and he had trouble coming out of the character because he was so invested. Was the movie you're thinking of The Marathon Man?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Because, but again, going into that, and there's so many other actors that may have damaged their career because they've gone so far into a character and they've never really come back out again.
Yeah, but, you know, that's baloney, Bill, really, seriously, even with Hoffman. It's, you know, so I think that the quote that Olivier said to Hoffman was, "My dear, why don't you try acting?" But that he was acting. He was just, they came from very different worlds. You do not, you know, the whole damaged actor thing just incenses me.
Okay.
And, you know, we have had a couple of really brilliant artists that we've lost. Philip Seymour Hoffman. I was so angry with him for doing that because it gave all these actors permission to say, yes, to be that good, you have to be that messed up.
Right.
And I just don't believe that. I refuse to believe that. I will not, you know, it's not. There are, you know, you have to set an example as an actor. You have to set an example that you can be a healthy artist. You know, the whole tortured artist thing bores me to tears. I'm not interested in that. It's such a, you know, indulgence. It's like teenagers indulging in drama.
Right.
You know, it's like grow up, be professional, you know? Enter and exit freely.
So again, last time we talked, we did the same thing. We went way off the rails. Now we got to come back on the rails again.
Yeah.
So when we talk about your masterclass, watching it and you giving the actor themselves a brief moment to explain who they are and how long they've been doing it and why. Why do you feel that's important?
Well, because I want them, part of what we were just talking about, I want them to be present. I want them to be able to talk about their work. That's their training for when they're sitting with the director and they want to talk about their work. Because actors just go off the, you know, they act and then they come to the seat and they're still dramatic. And I want them to, like, you know, okay, get here. Let's talk. Tell me what you wanted to work on. Be a professional. And so they're trained to that. You know, I worked on this. I wanted to do this. You've told me about this. And so I did these things. My lesson is, you know, those kinds of things. And it's usually not so brief. You know, they go on and on and on. We cut. I can't tell you what
I can imagine.
We had, I don't know, 140 hours of film. And we cut it into 16 episodes. and anywhere between 30 and 40 minutes each. And we cut a lot, you know, a lot of conversation at the top. So we can get to the critique, which is, you know,
so the what first they're there for. The first piece you show is with a younger actress who is playing a psychiatrist, psychologist, whatever it may be, and an older gentleman coming into the room, not that much older, about 5, maybe 6 years.
Yeah.
And there's a few references that he makes that she does not understand, and that a few of the members in the audience laugh at. Now, my age, I understood what they were saying because they were making reference to Doogie Howser and stuff like that.
Oh,
and
yeah,
She said, "Who is that?" And the audience chuckled in the back. When you have a piece like that, and maybe the line or the joke, whatever it is, falls flat when you expect there to be a laugh, how do you deal with that? Because if no one knew who Doogie Howser was, that wouldn't have played as well as it did.
Right. Well, you know, that's from a film called 50-50. So it's a pretty well-written script,
okay,
for starters. And it's kind of wonderful when actors work on film scenes because they tend to open them up. They also use the technique, and sometimes they'll do a little improvisation and then they'll write that improvisation into the scene. In terms of how do you deal with it as an actor on stage, and you think you're going to get a laugh and you don't get a laugh, you know, you're trained. Comedy is a whole other thing, and in this training you're not trained to listen for laughs or worry about laughs, or you're trained to the truth of the scene. And it's very funny that she's so young. I mean, the scene is she is a young shrink, and this is like her first patient.
She's
and
24 years old in, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and he comes in and he's gorgeous and he's dying of cancer. And it's how did these two people get on the same page? And then we added, it's not in the film, that they actually have an attraction to one another. Uh-huh. But, you know, since 99.9% of Hollywood is about attraction to one another, I always tell them add that into any mix that you can. So they do that really, really well, I think. But she's not, nobody's going to get thrown because they did or didn't get a laugh. I remember doing a scene in class, and sometimes some of the best work I've ever seen was in class. But I did a scene from class from, something, oh God, I don't know how I'm going to remember it. Lenny Bruce.
Okay.
And I was playing Honey, which is really not my part, but I had so much fun. I had fur and this and that and the other thing. And I don't know what went on stage. I have no idea what was going on. But people were laughing their asses off. And at places I didn't think, you know, we were kind of looking at each other on stage going, I didn't think this was that funny. Did you? You know, having that kind of connection with each other. Because you have to hold for the lines and you just, right, the laughs, and you just look at each other and carry on. But you know, we're not trained to it. We're just trained to move through the piece with our choices that work as kind of landmarks, you know.
Okay.
I talk about structure and freedom. The more structure you have, the more freedom you can have. So when you're rehearsing and you create, you know, this is the place where I put the fur jacket on and rub my face against the feel of the fur. And this is the place where you hand me a cup of tea. You kind of track these behavioral things that you discover in these behaviors that you discover in rehearsal that tell the story, because the behavior tells the story. The words don't tell the story. The behavior tells the story. So through the words, the actor works backwards. He works from the words to the behaviors, because that's connected to the feelings.
So the 16 actors that were taking part in the master class, you mentioned that you worked with them before.
Yes.
And you were working with them before. When those people first came in to see you, did they have an acting background, say 20 years ago when they came in, or that was it just an interest that you were able to take them on this journey to get to where they are now?
Well, you know, I've had actors who've come in that are currently shooting series.
Right.
And I have, it's very unusual that I interviewed every student. I chose every student. We always had a long waiting list. And I didn't choose people by audition. I didn't choose them by desire. I chose them by desire. I didn't choose them by talent. You know, he's so talented. I chose beginners because they had this passion that I saw. And in my interviews with them, I felt I could work with them and help them and that they were castable. I chose people because I wanted some beginners and some very advanced people. You know, when you have an actor who's on a series and they haven't ever trained before, it's very brave of them to come to acting class because everybody knows them and they haven't done any acting training. So they're very insecure because they're just shooting from the hip. And so it's wonderful to have beginners in class with them because I lay all the beginning work in for the beginners. And then the very advanced students kind of pick up on that.
Right.
Oh, this is how it starts. And so I have a kind of a formula to mix and match and, you know, have age and ethnicities and, you know, really, really broad array of humanity because, you know, that's what acting is all about. They're telling us how to be better human beings.
Do you have anyone that has gone on stage and just froze on you because they were afraid not of what you were going to say, but what the rest of the class was going to say about them?
I've never had anybody freeze. I think they I know they've been very, very nervous, but you know, I have a technique. And so the first thing any actor does on stage is they create a place to live in. And then they study their rhythms in life. So if you and I made an omelet, if you made an omelet and I made an omelet and we filmed it, those would be two entirely different stories. You would make an omelet one way, I would make an omelet another way. I teach the actor to make an omelet and study himself. His rehearsal for a week or two is to make that same omelet. And study very carefully, how do I cut the mushrooms? How do I do the butter? How every single detail of that behavior. And then they create that place on stage and then they repeat those behaviors. So they just start by living because acting is a little like this. These are the lines, and this is me rubbing my tummy with the behaviors. You know, you connect to the behaviors and then you let the lines come out. So to coordinate them, they only do one thing, and that's the behavior. They're so anxious to get to the lines. I don't want them. I won't let them do the lines for a while. So we teach them other things.
I was with a group of friends over the weekend, and we were imbibing just a little bit. And most of us are close to retirement age. And someone said, "What do you want to do after retirement?" And I've always wanted to say, "I want to go back into radio full time," and or "I want to teach broadcasting to students." And I figured, you know what? I want to go in a different direction because I knew I was going to be talking to you this week. And I said, I always wanted to be able to act, maybe not publicly, but to feel comfortable doing it, because I did it in high school. I did it briefly in college, and that was so long ago. And a couple years back, I had the opportunity to audition for somebody, and I talk every day. I do this every day. I couldn't do it. I froze. And it was like one of those situations is, I don't know if it was because I had something that I had to read or something I had to do, because this is easy. This is just a conversation back and forth. I don't have anything written down. I do doodle when we talk. That's what my hand's doing down below to keep me busy. So this is easy, but to do someone else's lines, I've always been
Well, you have
intimidated
no
because,
training.
but how do I get that training?
Well, you have to find a good acting teacher
Well,
because
that
there's
ain't
a
going to
lot
happen
of
in Western
there's
Pennsylvania.
no, it's not, but there's a well, watch the series. There's a lot of bad acting training out there, people don't know what actors do.
That's
Even the people hiring them don't know what actors do. They think, well, some of them come in and they're fabulous, and I really believe them. And some of them come in and they're nervous, and they're just kind of showing me something. you know, I don't want to hire them. I can't wait for the audition to be over because they make me nervous because they're so nervous. You know, an actor is not going to be nervous if he has something to do.
Right.
You didn't know what to do. And most people think, well, actors learn the lines. Mm-hmm. That's what they do. No, that's not what they do. They have to create life. You know, the lines are the last, they're the icing on top of the cake. It's really a coordination because you have to have inner life and You know, if you were coming to my class, because I had people come to study with me in their 60s, in their 70s. And I love to take people who've been around for a while and always wanted to be an actor and never did it. I used to love to work with them because, you know, they're dedicated. They're like, I can do this. Mm-hmm. And then they get the idea of it and they start getting the coordination, like riding a bike, and they're going, oh, I love this. So, for instance, if you were in class, casting is very, very important. You must have people. You don't have young people play old people. You have casting is like really important. So, you know, one of the things we do is to sit you down in front of the class and have the class cast you. So it's interesting to hear how other people, I should have done that in the series. We didn't do that in the series, but it's interesting to hear how other people cast you, how they see you for parts. But right away, I would have you look at Giamatti's work, Paul Giamatti's work. Okay. He has a film out right now that's supposed to be wonderful. And so that you, once people are casting, you go, oh, look, they see me in these parts. And then mm-hmm. you look at those parts and you go, oh, I can see myself. I have something for this. Part of acting is you read a piece and you go, oh, I have something for this. Okay. And sometimes you read a piece and you go, this is not for me. It doesn't ring any bells with me. I don't have anything for this piece.
Because I've seen local theater and community theater, and there's always one or two that are really good. And then there's always this one guy or this woman that everything they're in, it's the same character over and over again, because there's no, they just play themselves. And it's like, why doesn't someone tell them that they need to do something different instead of walking through the way they would normal life? Just because they're on stage, they've done it enough times, of course they're not going to be nervous now because they've been doing it for years. But yet they're not being the part.
Yeah. Well, it's a type. They are being the part. You know, there's bad writing too. Bad writing is writing types. You know, it's derivative writing. You're writing a character that you've seen in 25 movies, and it's derivative in all 25 of those movies, and it's usually played by the same actor.
Right.
You know, Sandy Dennis was such a beautiful actor, and the first time I saw Sandy Dennis, I went, oh my God, she's just fantastic, because she's very different and very unique. And I saw her in Elizabeth and Burton played, and it's very famous, and I'm blanking on it, Melfi piece. Anyway, she played this young woman, very neurotic, very, you know. And she was so good. I'd never seen anything like her. And then I saw her in another film and I tracked it down. I want to see what Sandy Dennis does in this. And it was the same. And then the same and the same. And I, you know, was it the part? Was it that the same parts kept coming to her and stimulating, oh, this is the answer to that part? And she was very personal. She was very good. But it became very limited. I wanted somebody to give her a part with a different energy and different sensibilities, you know? So it's hard to say what comes first, the chicken or the egg, but she got locked into a kind of a character, and people said, well, that's what she does. She did it very, very well, but you have to be able to, on the other hand, you take somebody like Sissy Spacek, and she just, you know, she has a very distinct quality to mm-hmm. her, but she's able to really, get a broad array of characters out of that uniqueness.
Because I find that interesting, that happens. Now, the other thing, and with your grandchild, as you told me beforehand, he loves screens. And I'm sure you can see the maybe that the actor is coming out at him in such a young age. But when we get on stage and people get nervous, like you said, is that a skill that we've learned, or is that a skill that we are born with? Because I know when we talk about embarrassment, I think embarrassment is something that we're taught because we've been told not to do it, not to do it. And then when you're finally up there doing it, you're going, but wait a minute, I was told I wasn't supposed to do this. And that's, and you looking at a child at this young age now, are you able to see where that comes from?
Well, you know, children change. So he's very open right now and he loves screens. And you know, when I raised my daughter, I raised her in Rudolf Steiner education, where they're not supposed to watch television until they're like in the sixth grade or something, because it really crimps your imagination. Mm-hmm. You know, screens really, you know, they tell you how things should look. Mm-hmm. They're delivering information all the time. And, you know, I blame our illiteracy problem on television and film and screens and social media, because, you know, when you read a book, when I read All the Light You Cannot See, which is one of the most magnificent books ever written, it's utterly magnificent. Everyone should read that book. It's a classic. There's a reason it won a Pulitzer Prize. Beautiful book. If I read that book and you read that book, we make pictures in our heads. I have a movie in my head of All the Light You Cannot See, and you have a movie in your head of All the Light You Cannot See. So most of the time when Hollywood comes along and makes their version of All the Light You Cannot See, I'm disappointed.
Right.
But I was not. I thought they did a breathtaking job with this book. But you know, when you're delivered pictures all the time, and young people now are growing up in front of the television, and they don't read books. People don't read for pleasure. And I think it's because of screens. You know, why do I have to go through the trouble of making, you know, taking words and putting them together and creating a picture when it's all delivered to me? You know, we get lazy. We want it delivered. We want to be entertained. But, you know, when you read and you make pictures in your head, you are stimulating your imagination. You do that with your imagination. And imagination is the most important thing on the planet. It has to do with evolution. We imagined every wonderful forward leap we ever took. You know, somebody imagined it and then we went, oh, good idea.
Right.
So the education, reading is terribly, terribly important to education.
And the other thing is, too, is that, and I've seen this in my three kids, because my wife and I are both of a creative background, her more in music and me doing what I do, is that I could see that in my children, but in other people's children, they had no imagination because mm-hmm. everything was in front of them. They didn't find enjoyment or pleasure. And the other thing, they couldn't keep themselves busy. They mm-hmm. were bored. They couldn't be by themselves. They always had to have something in front of them.
Well, that's connected.
My kids yeah. would disappear, pen and paper, crayons, whatever it is, and they would just draw and they would build things and everything else. And it's really interesting to see that, because the more kids and the more adults that I deal with that are in their 20s and early 30s, everything has to be handed to them. They can't yeah. think. They can't yeah. forecast what's going to happen next. If yeah. this happens, then this will happen. And they yeah. don't see that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the function of imagination, is, you know, it play, children's play. So, you know, in these Waldorf schools, they start in kindergarten telling stories. Mm-hmm. And so I had to drive a carpool with five kids. And three of them were from South Africa. And they were just wonderful, wonderful children. But they, because they were raised in this education where they, from the kindergarten, they were listening to stories. And then they come back the next day and that story would expand. And they come down the next day and the story would expand. So they'd tell a story for a week. you know, and the kids are like adding on to the story in their imagination. They're learning to draw in their imagination. Now, when they go to play, it's easy because they have this imagination. And it's not that some children don't have an imagination. It's that it hasn't been exercised. It hasn't been encouraged. You know, that's part of the reason I wrote the book, was to teach people to think for themselves, mm-hmm. to make decisions for themselves from their imagination, from their heart.
And I know people, you and I have been talking now for almost an hour, and it's been a constant flow of a conversation. Yes. I know people that can't do that because they can't figure out where to go next or what to ask next, because again, and they're my age and they can't do that. And we're losing the art of conversation because of social media, because of text messages. I remember being a kid sitting around my grandmother's table at Thanksgiving and whatever, and just hearing stories about people I never knew, but yet they were family and we have those stories. I'm afraid the next two or three generations, if it's not on video, no one's going to remember these people.
Well, I think it's going to swing. I think we've hopefully swung so far over that we understand, you know, the pandemic didn't help things.
Oh, no,
either.
Not at all. Not at all.
So I think people are longing for it. And I think it will swing back. Hopefully it will swing back. People don't know how to date. People are not getting married. Boys don't know how to turn into men, and women don't know, you know, because we've given all these ridiculous messages. Women should be
right
and down with the men and you know, the whole, I mean, you and I tend to go to these political places in our conversation, but you know, the Me Too thing, I mean, yes, I understand. Listen, you know, I'm a woman. I grew up. I saw a lot of things. I experienced a lot of things. But by the same token, I was taught to take care of myself. You don't go to a director's hotel room
right.
and then complain that he tries to get into your pants. I'm sorry. But, you know, come on. It's all too extreme. So the whole, this goes too far. It's got to come back toward the center. And, you know, we've talked about this before, because I know that you're in dedicated to education, that it should start with the education system. If it doesn't start with the education system, then it has to be people like you talking about it on mm-hmm. your show, and people like me writing about it and going around. We just have to keep doing what we can do to help people live lives that they feel were worth it, that they feel were personal to them and worth it. And, you know, in the book, there's that exercise called the joy list for people that you're talking about. They can't have a conversation. They don't know what they should be doing. They have no joy in their life.
Right.
Well, there's an exercise, you know, to really dig out. When was the last time I was happy? Have I ever been happy in my whole life? You know, if I could have anything in the world, what would I want if there were no obstacles? Mm-hmm. You know, so there, you have to go digging for it sometimes. We want to teach people to think for themselves. We want to stimulate imagination. And we want people to have a joyous life, because otherwise, what are we doing?
And I agree with you totally. And we're going to end it there, because I think that's a great way to put a cap on this. Jocelyn, where can they find your masterclass?
Oh, you can find everything at Jocelyn Jones Studio. Jocelyn is Jocelyn, jonesstudio.com.
I wish you luck. How long has it been out so far?
I think it came out in the late spring. So okay. Not very long. Not okay. Very long. Yeah.
So I wish you all the luck in the world with it.
Thank you.
Wonderful holiday season.
Yes.
Because I know there's going to be a grandson that's going to be spoiled rotten over the next few months.
Well, he's going to be loved up, that's for sure. I don't know if that's spoiled rotten, but he's going to be loved up. And because it's Thanksgiving, I want to say one last thing about what we were talking about with joy. One of the greatest ways to bring joy into your life is to sit down and be grateful for what you have, and really be conscious of that, and really think about that, and hold hands and talk about what we do have, not what we don't have.
Right. I agree with you totally.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. You have a great
Happy Thanksgiving.
We'll talk to you next. Happy Thanksgiving to you too.
Yeah.
Hey, a big thank you goes out to Joslyn Jones for joining me today. Had a wonderful time talking about her book that's now available on Amazon called Artist, Awakening the Spirit Within, and also her masterclass, In Class, Joslyn Jones, a masterclass series. And all this is available at her website, joslynjonesstudio.com. You can check that out at joselynjonesstudio.com. Everybody, thank you very much for joining me today and taking part of the Bill Alexander Show. New slogan, empowering minds one conversation at a time. Guys, you have a great one. We'll talk to you next time here on the Bill Alexander Show.
Thank you for listening to the Bill Alexander Show. The Bill Alexander Show is a $1 Million Baby production. For more information, go to thebillalexandershow.com.